So welcome everyone. So nice to see you. Some new faces and some familiar faces. So the title of the talk tonight is The Gate of Heaven is Everywhere. This last weekend, my teaching colleague, Rabbi Rami Shapiro, and I were teaching at St. Mary's Retreat Center in Sewanee. And the content of our retreat was birthing the Christ within. So it was wonderful to have a Jewish rabbi and mystic and Episcopal priest and meditation teacher teaching together about this Jewish rabbi from Galilee. And Rami had a visual. Rami is just such a wonderful teacher. And he had a visual which I had not heard him use before, seen him use before. And it helped make a lot of sense of things for me. He said, if you think about religious communities, different religions, in their parochial form, they're like, you know, just separate silos. You know, here's Judaism and here's Islam and here's Christianity and here's Hinduism and native religions. And they're really in these silos, and they don't really have a whole lot to say to each other. In fact, the things that they have to say may be relatively competitive. And then in 1893, in Chicago, a singular event happened, and it was the Congress of World Religions. It was the first time in the world's history there had been a gathering of spiritual teachers who were having a conversation with each other about the essence of their practices. And we could think of this as sort of interreligious dialogue. So you've got, you know, these silos, these different groups, but now there's some arrows that are kind of connecting them. And these conversations were sort of like, well, you know, this is what we as Jews believe. This is what we as Sunni Muslims believe. This is what we as Shiites believe. This is what we as evangelical Christians believe, Orthodox Christians believe. Obviously, there's not one Christianity, not one Judaism, not one Islam, but many different Christianities, etc., etc. Then in the 1970s, and this was really the monastics, Catholic monastics, Buddhist monastics, Hindu practitioners, who began to have this conversation at the behest of Father Thomas Keating, the Trappist monk in Snowmass, Colorado. And this was really not inter-religious dialogue, but inter-spiritual practice. And so these groups were doing different practices together, and the boundaries between these practices these faiths became so much more porous. They weren't really talking about what we believe as much as this is what we know through our practice. And what they found as they talked with each other over several decades of getting together was, oh, there is this common core that belongs to all our traditions. And so we could really say that common core is the perennial tradition, as it's called. And you could think of it as kind of a bunch of overlapping Venn diagrams, where, yes, there are these things that are peculiar culturally and linguistically to these different traditions, but there's also this significant overlap. And that's what Rami and I are interested in teaching, is this overlap of perennial wisdom, that everything is a manifestation of this that cannot be named. We'll call it the divine. And that we as human beings have the capacity to know this. This one thing that we all are, this one ocean of which we are individual manifesting waves. It's possible for us to know this and to live out of this an ethic of compassion and wisdom and justice. And this living out of this vocation of compassion and wisdom and justice is our highest calling. It's a calling that all of us have as human beings. So with this backdrop, the content or the structure of our retreats is we get up in the morning and we do some Qigong, we do some mindful movement out on the bluff there, which is just this killer view that overlooks the valley below. And then we come in and we do some calm abiding as we did this evening, just some sitting meditation. We have breakfast in silence. And then we move to textual study, and Rami, being the rabbi, is really a master of textual exposition. You know, the rabbis don't think there's just one interpretation of a scriptural passage, but they like to debate and argue and say, oh, I see this in the text, and oh, but I see this in the text. It's a whole lot more fun way of working with scriptural text than, you know, this is the one orthodox way to read this. And Rami's not just a master of Jewish texts, but texts from other traditions as well. And so we were working some texts from Proverbs and the Beatitudes and the Prodigal Son. I did some teaching about different levels of embodied consciousness. After all, that's the story of Jesus, that the divine became enfleshed, incarnatus, enfleshed in this particular person, as the divine is no less enfleshed in each one of us. He just came to remind us of that. Early Sunday morning, 5:30 Sunday morning, we did a ritual that we've never done before. We got up in the dark and we lit our candles and we made a quiet procession out to the memorial garden where my wife Kathy's ashes are spread. And as I've told you before, there are these great shoji Shinto gates. And before we went out, Rami said to me, I want you to wear what I wear. I want you to wear this tallit, this Jewish robe with fringes. You perhaps have seen these robes. And he showed me the ritual way to put this on. And it was really a very moving moment for me to have this rabbi invite his Christian brother to put on this Jewish garment. And so he said, I want you to lead us in silence out to the garden. And so the Taoists say, walk on the earth as though you're walking on ice, with that kind of carefulness. So we're walking with that sort of mindfulness out to the garden. And when we got to the gates, we made our bows and we went in. And Rami had us read, sort of responsively, a second century Gnostic text. Only Rami could come up with this, called the Hymn to Jesus. It's from a pretty obscure text called the Acts of John. And I'm going to read just a little piece of this to you. See what you think it sounds like. If you would save, you also must save. If you would be free, you must also set free. If you would eat, you must also be eaten. If you would be cleansed, you also must clean. If you would be heard, you must also hear. If you would be embraced, you must also embrace. If you would be adorned, you must also adorn. If you would be healed, you must also heal. I hear some echoes in this of the book of Ecclesiastes, that wisdom book of the Hebrew Bible of the Old Testament. They also hear some Taoist echoes in just the language, the rhythm of these words. And I want to unpack them just a little bit for us, because I think there is a way to read them, a way to hear them, that may be even deeper than at first reading. If you would be saved, you also must save. If you would be saved, normally we think of I, you, me, and this conventional, familiar way of a separate self, a conditioned self, the way the mind is habituated for us to see as separate from one another. But if we move into, as I've been talking about for the balance of this year, a different kind of consciousness, which experiences, not just sees, but experiences one another as in altogether in a larger space, in a larger consciousness. For after all, everyone who is in this room right now is in your consciousness. We are already in you. I am in you right now. You don't have a choice about that. I just am. And you are in my awareness. Again, we don't get to choose. It's already the case. We are saved. We are set free. We are healed. We are cleansed when we drop into that different consciousness. In that different consciousness, there are differences. Yes, there are Shiite Muslims. There are Native Americans. There are Orthodox Jews. There are Reformed Jews. There are all these different manifestations of spiritual practice. Yet, we are all one in this larger consciousness, which is beyond naming. So we read this hymn to Jesus, and then we walked the labyrinth. There's a labyrinth there. Of course, if you've been to the great cathedral at Chartres, you know there's a labyrinth there on the floor of the cathedral. Has its twists and turns. It's one thing to walk. How many of us have walked a labyrinth? I'm just curious to see. Yeah, probably more than half of us. So, you know, there are all these twists and turns. And if you do it by yourself, it's one thing. But to do it with a group of 20 or 30 other folks, that's a very different experience. Because you're on the path and they're on the path and everybody's going these different ways. Everybody's trying to find their way to the center. So Rami asked me to stand at the center and to read, as the sun was coming up, the almost full moon was up in the sky, and the Big Dipper was up in the sky, and the sun was just beginning to come up as we were in the labyrinth. The whole thing felt fairly druidic. I mean, it really felt fairly primeval. It was just a very cool experience. So Rami asked me to read this piece from a Dharma talk that I had given last December around the time of the winter solstice. And I'll just read this little piece to you. It's appropriate to pause and consider light, photons, and the sun. It was in 1543 that an obscure Polish astronomer named Nicholas Copernicus announced that the sun, not the earth, is the center of the world, center of the universe. This broke with a 2-million-year tradition of human knowing. We are 93 million miles from this center, this sun, this star. It takes the light in this great giveaway 8 minutes and 20 seconds to reach us. Our sun each second transforms 4 million tons of itself into light, some of which becomes energy that we, with every meal, partake of. This light transforming itself is the great cosmic giveaway. The sun is a million times the size of the earth. We're held by the sun's gravity. We're soaring around a star that floats in the vast ocean of the universe. The sun is one of 300 billion stars in the Milky Way, which itself is one of a trillion galaxies in an ever-expanding universe. Before the 20th century, we didn't even know there were other galaxies in the universe. The Milky Way is whipping our solar system 180 miles every second. So every 20 seconds, we have been flung 3,600 miles, a distance equal to the length of the North American continent. Even more mind-blowing, and even Einstein didn't at first believe his own equations until Edwin Hubble showed him the evidence that this universe is ever expanding. Everything is moving away from us, and it's moving away from our neighbor, the Andromeda Galaxy, and every other place. The universe flared forth into existence from a density smaller than an electron, 13.7 billion light years away. And not somewhere over there, because there wasn't space over there. All light and energy, what we are and everything else is made of, as well as space and time themselves, flared forth here, there, and everywhere. Every place in the universe is the origin point. The Earth is the center of the universe, and every other place is too. What's expanding is space itself. We are paradoxically at the center of the universe and 13.7 billion light years from that center. This is an omnicentric universe. Every place is at the center. And just to make this even more jaw-dropping, for the mathematics of string theory to work out, physicists now think it's not just a universe, it's a multiverse. There are infinite universes out there. So as we're walking the labyrinth and making our way to the center, we're hearing just where we are in this multiverse. Afterwards, after we went back inside and warmed ourselves up from the morning chill, Rami said that this was a different experience than he had ever had doing any kind of ritual. And he's done a lot of rituals as a rabbi. And he said, you know, usually I just feel so, responsible for people to have a good experience and for this to come off well and all that sort of stuff. And I thought, oh man, I know that drill. And he said, there just wasn't any of that going on tonight. It was just unfolding in its own way. Rami was, in the words of our meditation tonight, allowing everything to be the way it was. There's a phrase that I ran across in the teacher I've been reading recently, Rupert Spira, and he talks about stretching the edge of the now. I meant to bring a rubber band, but I forgot to do it. But if you think of this virtual rubber band in my hands, you know, here's the now. Oh, and this is the now too, right? And now is now. It's the eternal now. It's always now. But what we're doing is stretching at the edge of the now. We're trying to get out there to have it come out the way we want it to come out, right? Or we're stretching it back this way. We wish it had been this way, and we so wish we could rework the past. We're thinking about how the past should have been, or might have been, or could have been. We're stretching at the edge of the now. And so there's always this tension, this friction, when we're stretching at the edge of the now. But when we're not stretching at the edge of the now, we're just right here, right now. I am now. When Moses stood at the burning bush and asked what the name was that was of the voice that was coming from the center of that bush, the answer he got was, I am. I am now. Think about this I that we know ourselves to be. This I, this body, these memories, these sensations, these perceptions, these have been changing all my life. And yet, I feel that there's something stable when I use the word I to refer to myself. What is this that's stable and unchanging? It's this is-ing in this now. It is, to use the mindfulness word, the present moment. All our thoughts about the future are only happening now. All your thoughts about the past, they're only happening now. And there was something, and maybe it was because we were separated from our electronic devices and we were just out there with the stars. You can really see the stars up there in Swanee. You can see the Milky Way and the almost full moon and the sun just peeking over the horizon. Maybe it was because we were in that sort of setting. But nobody was straining at the edge of the now. And I've kept getting these emails from people this week saying, that was just the most wonderful experience. It's always available to us. You know, it's happening every morning. Thomas Merton called it le point vierge. The virgin point. This point where the day is being born again. We have a chance to come into the now and be born again. At the end of our retreat, we always do this, this Eucharist. And you don't have to be a card-carrying Christian to come to this Eucharist. The table is open to everybody. And so here's this Jewish rabbi, and he's saying the blessing over the bread and the blessing over the wine in his Hebrew words. And I'm saying these words. When Jesus was at supper with his friends for the last time, he took bread and he blessed it and he broke it and he gave it to them and said, take and eat. This is my body. The body of Jesus is our body, all bodies, broken on the cross of forgetting, resurrected into wholeness when remembered. Remember, recognize, realize who you are. That's the whole point of the ritual. When he says, do this in remembrance of me, yes, to be sure, it's the Jewish rabbi who lived 2,000 years ago, but he's saying, do it in remembrance of who you are. do it in remembrance of this consciousness in which we are all one together. All of us. Whether we count ourselves in a particular religious tradition or not necessarily in any kind of tradition at all. Somebody in our group who listens to these talks is not often able to be here. She lives out of town. Sent me a link to a Krista Tippett, you know, Krista Tippett on Being. And she sent me a link to an interview that that Krista Tippett had had with Father Greg Boyle, who's a Jesuit. Any of you hear this one? Yeah, some of you did. It's just, I like, really go home and listen to this. He's a Jesuit who works with gangs in L.A., and he's just so funny. He's so smart and so funny, and it's just a delight to listen to him. But the way he ends his conversation with Krista, he quotes what's one of his favorite poems. It's by Hafiz, the 14th century Persian poet. So many people in Iran have Hafiz in their homes, and this poem's called "With That Moon Language." So Hafiz says, "Admit something. Everyone you see, you say to them, 'Love me.' Of course, you do not do this out loud, otherwise someone would call the cops. Still, though, think about this. This great pull in us to connect. Why not become the one who lives with a full moon in each eye that's always saying, with that sweet moon language, what every other eye in this world is dying to hear? What's everyone in this world dying to hear? I love you. That's what we all want to hear." Somebody once said that we ought to come with a sign that's hung around our neck saying, "Please don't hurt me." That's the other side of the same coin. Please don't hurt me. There's an important conversation going on in our culture right now. Women are saying, "I've been hurt." It's a very important conversation we're having. Please don't hurt me. Please love me. So I want to end with Thomas Merton tonight. It will be the anniversary of Merton's death on December 10th. He's a very coincidental kind of guy. So at the age of 27, on December 10th, 1941, 3 days after Pearl Harbor, he enters the Trappist Monastery at Gethsemane. 27 years later, on December 10th, he dies by electrocution in Bangkok, Thailand, where he's talking about Buddhist-Christian dialogue. He's talking to monks and nuns, Buddhist and Christian. So this is one of Merton's big experiences of love. Comes from his book, Conjections of a Guilty Bystander. What a great title. In Louisville, at the corner of 4th and Walnut, in the center of the shopping district, I was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all these people, that they were mine and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another even though we are total strangers. It was like waking from a dream of separateness, of spurious self-isolation in a special world, the world of renunciation and supposed holiness. The whole illusion of a separate holy existence is a dream. Not that I question the reality of my vocation or of my monastic life, but the conception of separation from the world that we have in the monastery too easily presents itself as a complete illusion. The illusion that by making vows we become a different species of being, pseudo-angels. This sense of liberation from an illusory difference was such a relief and joy to me that I almost laughed out loud. And I suppose my happiness could have taken form in the words, thank God that I am like other people, that I am only a person among others. To think that for 16 or 17 years, I've been taking seriously this pure illusion that is implicit in so much of our monastic thinking. It is a glorious destiny to be a member of the human race, dedicated to many absurdities, and one which makes terrible mistakes, and yet with all that, God glories in becoming a member of the human race. A member of the human race. To think that such a commonplace realization should suddenly seem like news that one holds the winning ticket in a cosmic sweepstake. I have the immense joy of being a member of the race in which God became incarnate. There are no strangers. Then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts. The depths of their hearts where neither sin nor desire nor self-knowledge can reach, the core of their reality, the person that each one is in God's eyes. If only they could all see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way all the time. There'd be no more war, no more hatred, no more cruelty, no more greed. That expression, le point vierge, that moment between darkness and light, comes in here. At the center of our being is a point of pure truth, a point or spark which belongs entirely to God, which is never at our disposal, from which God disposes of our lives, which is inaccessible to the fantasies of our own mind or the brutalities of our own will. This little point of nothingness and of absolute poverty is the pure glory of God within us. It is, so to speak, God's name written in us. As our poverty, our indigence, our dependence, as our son and daughtership. It's like a pure diamond blazing with the invisible light of heaven. It's in everybody. And if we could see it, we would see these billions of points of light coming together in the face and blaze of a sun that would make all the darkness and cruelty of life vanish completely. I have no program for this seeing. It's only given. But the gate of heaven is everywhere. So that's it for a moment. So it's our practice to end our time together with some loving kindness meditation, metta meditation as it's called in the Buddhist tradition. In this meditation, we make contact with that little point of light that's in us and in all beings. And we always begin this meditation with ourselves, to remember, to recognize, to realize that we are fragments, we are incarnations of this one light. So think of some person, some persons in your life who have seen this light in you, who have recognized this light. And from the point of light in their hearts to the point of light in your heart, hear them saying to you, may you be free from fear. May you be free from obsession. May you dwell in peace. May you rest in the kingdom of love. And imagine it so. Imagine that their wishes are flaming forth from that point in your heart into every cell in your body, lighting up the DNA of every cell. And you return the favor. And you say to this one, to these ones, may you be free from fear. May every human being wants to be free from fear, to know happiness. May you be free from obsession, free from the obsession with control. May you dwell in peace, and the peace that passes all understanding, peace of the awakened heart and mind. May you rest in the kingdom of love. The love that moves the sun and the other stars, as Dante said. And we bring to mind our loved ones, those still here in form, those in formless being, our families, our friends, our teachers, our companions on the way. We bring to mind strangers. People of Israel, Jerusalem, Palestine. We bring to mind difficult persons, persons who make our lives harder. We know they too wish to be free from suffering and to be happy, just as we all do. And so we send these wishes out to all beings, all human beings, all more than human beings. May all beings be free from fear. May all beings be free from obsession, the obsessions of fear and hatred and control. All beings dwell in peace. May all beings be seen with the eyes of love. and imagine it so. We dedicate the merit of our practice this evening to the welfare of all beings, to the arising of joy and happiness and peace, and to the ending of suffering. So thank you for your kind attention. The meditation group that meets at my home Sunday evenings, 5 p.m., will be meeting this week, number 10, Peach Blossom Square. We'll meet the other Wednesdays of this month, except for the last Wednesday. We'll take that Wednesday off, the Wednesday after Christmas. So I hope you have a lovely week, peaceful week, and see you next week. Thank you.